Ethanol is a pretty tempting idea right now. It's got huge political support from George W. Bush, along with John McCain and Senator Barack Obama. And at a time when skyrocketing gas prices are putting the pressure on Americans, the thought of freeing ourselves from foreign oil and controlling production looks pretty good. But our guest today says not so fast. The benefits of ethanol are overhyped, and the environmental drawbacks are staggering. Good morning to you, Veronica Rickert, with you this week for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Ken Green, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His article, Ethanol and the Environment, appears in the Environmental Policy Outlook, the AEI's bimonthly newsletter. Ken Green, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, ethanol is a pretty attractive option right now politically. Both John McCain and Barack Obama support it, along with the current president. So it's pretty easy to see why ethanol would appeal at this point in time, isn't it?
It is, especially with prices at the pump being very high, which always makes people rather angry about both the dependence on or need for gasoline and the sources from which we get it. So, of course, any alternative fuel looks attractive when gas is $4 a gallon.
So let's talk a minute about what ethanol can offer, what the supporters of it are so excited about.
Okay. Well, the supporters are excited about several things. There are overlapping goals, many of them sort of poorly defined. Some people talk about the idea of energy independence, where we're going to free ourselves from outside forces affecting the price and availability of energy. And in this case, they're really talking about transportation fuels, because if we wanted to be independent on energy for electricity, we can be at any time. In fact, I think we largely are with regard to coal and nuclear and other forms of electrical generation. This is really about transportation fuels. And so some people want to be independent of foreign influences, and that stems back all the way to the 1970s and the OPEC oil embargo. And every time the prices go up, people start talking about that again. Other people frame it in terms of oil or energy security, where they don't want to be sending U.S. dollars to people who want to kill us, right? Don't want to blow us up. And I don't think anybody does, but I also don't think there's much that can be done about that. Still others think of it in terms of environmental issues, where they have heard from people that it's better for the environment than gasoline is, which, as this outlook points out, is certainly not the case. And there's a whole myriad of reasons why people like it. They've heard it'll bring back family farming. They believe it's, you know, good for the heartland of the country, and so on and so on. And there are many reasons, but very few of them, if any, stand up to scrutiny.
Well, you take the position that ethanol is if not just imperfect, then possibly really dangerous and harmful idea to be pushing right now. Tell us a little bit about why you think that is.
Well, the main reason is, well, there are several reasons. And so first, from my point of view, I'm an environmental scientist by training, is that the more we look at ethanol, the worse it is for the environment. It turns out that ethanol production and raising corn for ethanol, and even switchgrass for ethanol, will produce more, not less, greenhouse gases. It will produce more, not less, local air pollution, ozone especially. It generates ozone precursors. And ozone is the one that irritates lung disease and tends to kill people when the levels go up. It will generate more water pollution, both at the local level and also the ocean level, coastal water pollution. And it will also consume more land. As people divert more land for biofuel crops, the land which we've allowed to reforest in North America and also areas in the rainforest are going to be leveled and are being leveled to plant ethanol crops because there's suddenly a market in them that is more valuable than that marginal terrain where it wasn't worth farming before.
And how widely accepted is the evidence you're talking about? Is there a lot of debate out there on this right now?
I think actually it's becoming very widely accepted. There is the debate that exists basically is from the corn lobby and the ethanol industry. They have a huge vested interest. They get very large subsidies to produce ethanol and to raise corn for ethanol, and it gives corn a value that it otherwise wouldn't have as a food crop, and so there's a great deal of income involved. And politically speaking, those farm states carry a lot of weight, and so the political candidates and politicians in general love to pander to them by saying that, you know, ethanol is their great industry. But I think in the analytical world, including the environmentalist community, the realization is there that ethanol was a very bad idea, Some environmental groups have written basically that they wish they had never thought it was good for the environment because they allowed themselves to become tools of the corn lobby. And I think it's widely accepted that it is a very bad thing, but it also is very deeply entrenched now.
So what you got here, it seems as though, is a choice between two priorities. On the one hand, you've got the environmental issues, which you say are becoming more and more widely recognized. On the other hand, you've got the very real and urgent right now issue of gas prices and needing to free ourselves up a little bit. And you've got the economy, which is stumbling. So which direction do you turn?
It's a difficult choice. I would say that the problem with ethanol is it's not going to guarantee lower gasoline prices. In fact, many people have said that, you know, as we've learned that the climate's more variable than we thought, we're going to have bigger variations in crop productivity year to year. And so instead of putting ourselves dependent on the production of the whole world, different world suppliers of oil, we might make ourselves dependent on a bad crop one year with regard to where our fuel comes from and how much it costs. And we could see much more volatility in price with ethanol in our fuel than we ever do with gasoline, which historically has been pretty stable except for a few very serious spikes. So it's unclear that we get an economic benefit from ethanol. In fact, it's more expensive to produce generally than gasoline. And with oil dropping back down, that will again be the case probably if oil crosses the $100 a barrel mark. Ethanol will become more expensive to produce than gasoline would. With regard to employment, the claim that we'll generate more jobs with ethanol may be true, but, of course, these jobs are going to be at the expense of other jobs, which currently are producing gasoline and transporting gasoline and dispensing gasoline and so on. So there are always trade-offs with regard to the question of creating jobs.
Are there any other options besides using corn that might be less environmentally harmful? Maybe what about the switchgrass option?
Well, the switchgrass option, that's the one that most people have talked about is second-generation biofuels or even third. The problem with switchgrass is that, in a sense, nature has spoiled us. Nature spent millions of years concentrating the energy of algae and plant matter into oil and coal and peat and natural gas. And we're accustomed to very dense sources of energy, the result of millions and thousands of years of sunlight hitting an acre of land, gathered up into the oil that was produced on that area. And when you think about how much energy you can grab in a single year from growing grass, it's just not very much. And so if you want to replace a significant fraction of your energy, you have to plant massive swaths of the country in switchgrass. And we don't have those kind of massive areas that are arable to grow switchgrass that aren't already forested and or wilderness, areas, habitat areas. And so switchgrass itself is probably not a solution either. It would take too large an area to grow, and you'd have to move too many millions of tons of solid mass to the ethanol plants to make ethanol and then truck the ethanol rather than pipe it to blending stations to be put into gasoline or move to gas stations entirely. My hope is for something called algae biodiesel, which is the idea of growing algae on brackish water, water we don't drink, and or even ocean water, and using that to compress into a diesel fuel because algae is high in oil content.
Hmm.
And that offers the scale necessary. You can at least conceive of that on a scale necessary to produce a significant amount of fuel without displacing cropland.
So just going back to switchgrass for a moment, I should ask you, I don't really know what switchgrass is. I live in an agricultural state, but what is switchgrass and why is this supposed to be better?
Well, it's a medium-height grass that grows wild. It grows largely unirrigated. It's a fast-growing grass that has a high starch content to it, so it's got a decent amount of cellulose to it. It can be repeatedly cropped without uprooting. You don't generally have to replant it, I don't believe. So it's a perennial grass, and it's quite hardy, and it can grow in a pretty broad range of habitat without irrigation. But again, at the scale we would need to grow it, there would also have to be a significant part that was irrigated.
You actually tried to make your own ethanol, is that right?
Yes, I did.
When
I was a kid, I used to read Mother Earth News and Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, and I was a bit of a geek, which I never really grew out of. But I wanted to. I lived in the San Fernando Valley in California, which many people associate now with smog and valley talk. And I indeed went to the Sherman Oaks Galleria when it opened, so I was there at the time. But what they don't realize is that the San Fernando Valley was a huge orange and citrus grove area, growing area, until the 1960s and 70s. And the orange trees still dotted the entire area. When we go to school, you could collect, you could see bushels, literally bushels of giant navel oranges laying on the ground uneaten. And I had thought, you know, if you could take all that energy, that sugar and turn it into ethanol, we could actually put it in the car. And because the lines at the time were nasty from the Arab oil embargo. And so I decided I was going to build myself a solar still, which there was a nice design for one in Mother Earth News, and I went ahead and got a book on it and read about it. But it turned out you have to file so much paperwork with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that as a 17-year-old, there was just no way I could get permission to do it. And being a law-abiding kid, I didn't want to just go ahead and do it anyway. So my plans were scrapped before they got too far off the drawing board.
And fast forward to today, and here you are. You're still talking about ethanol.
Yes, it's something you never escape.
So tell me about algae. If that's such a palatable option, why aren't we doing that?
Well, people are looking at it. There are several pilot plants looking at algae biodiesel, both in terms of growing it in ponds that you bubble the exhaust from a coal plant through, and the algae use the carbon in the exhaust to grow and sunlight to grow more algae. You harvest the algae, you press them dry, and you use that to replace gasoline, which means that you get to basically use the same carbon from coal twice. And you don't use the carbon from the gasoline at all. So you have a net carbon savings, reduction to the atmosphere, but you grow algae. And others are doing this with regard to not just bubbling exhaust through it, but simply growing it in large ponds and harvesting it.
I gather this isn't ready to go.
No. None of these technologies are ready to go. I mean, switchgrass, they haven't actually gotten out of the laboratory in terms of trying to break down cellulose and make ethanol. There are no ready-to-go technologies to replace oil, probably in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. I mean, back when I was going to make ethanol, it was, you know, even when I was going to distill it from oranges, people were saying, well, cellulosic ethanol, switchgrass-type ethanol, is only 10 years away. And that was the 1970s. It was 10 years away. And it was 10 years away in the 80s as well when I was in my master's working in biology, and 10 years in the 90s. Still, it's 10 to 20 years away now.
Can you give me a sense of how big the environmental issues that you're talking about are? You mentioned the air pollutants, the huge use of land and water. You mentioned the increasing greenhouse gases. Is this something, if we went ahead and pursued ethanol on a bigger level, bigger quantities, devoting more land, is that something which would have a really tangible and, you know, big effect on most people in the country? Or is this something that's going to be, you know, sort of a blip?
No, I think the more it's a ratio thing. The more you use, the worse these problems get. The problem is to grow corn requires a great deal of fertilizer and pesticides, and those run off into surface waters. They go out into the Gulf of Mexico and into the Chesapeake Bay, and they cause huge dead zones in the summertime where nothing can grow because the algae eat all the nutrients and use up all the oxygen, and nothing can grow in those areas. And that's just going to grow. The more you use, the worse it gets. And if people remember the 1970s, the reason the environmental movement started with bubbling, you know, foaming rivers and huge dead areas and dying lakes, we could go back there. I don't think anybody wants to go back there. And the air pollution increases we're talking about are 4, 5, 6%, 7%. Well, I mean, getting little tiny tenths of a percent cost millions and millions of dollars in places like Los Angeles, and people had to sacrifice their many of the things they held dear. They lost a lot of industry to other states and other countries. And we're talking about going back to that 1970s, 1980s levels of pollution, and I think it's unacceptable.
Well, why not invest a little in ethanol now? You know, we've got the corn variety, which is working, and get the machinery rolling, get us headed in that direction, and then try to switch with the technology over to something like algae now. But don't we have to support it now so that it's ready to go in the future?
Well, they're very different technologies. And the problem with this is that if we get past dependent on the wrong technology and we build a huge vested interest, which is going to crusade against any alternatives, we can find ourselves stuck down the wrong path. And ethanol, when you look at this, just the basic chemistry of ethanol, it does not look like it's going to be a promising pathway to go down. The other technologies are very different in terms of what you would do to produce the fuel and distribute the fuel. And infrastructure is a question that no one has really considered, where you're moving literally millions and millions of tons of biomass to and from ethanol plants and then trucking the ethanol. The infrastructure that you'd have to build in order to do that is a 50-60 year investment. And if we go down the wrong pathway, we're going to strand just a huge amount of wealth and squander a lot of resources that really, with our economy the way it is, and anytime, even when the economy is good, you can't afford to waste that kind of resource.
Talking about ethanol this hour with Ken Green, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His article, Ethanol and the Environment, appears in the Environmental Policy Outlook. That's the AEI's bimonthly newsletter. Well, what do you think about ethanol? Do you think it could help the economy and help free us from dependence on foreign oil? Or do you think that this is an imperfect solution, that it could be costly to Americans in terms of the environment and in their pocketbooks, ultimately? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you this morning at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. The home should be a pretty safe place for you and your family, but it turns out there are dangerous chemicals lurking in your home, stuff that most of us never think about, but that we use from day to day. Next hour, we'll be talking about the 10 most dangerous things in your home with Kristen Conger. She's going to be talking with us as the author of that article, and she writes for HowStuffWorks.com. Veronica Rickert with you this morning. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about ethanol this morning with Ken Green, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He did an article called Ethanol and the Environment, which details the problems with ethanol. And Ken Green, let's go to the phones right now. We've got a call from Rich calling from East Troy. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Rich. Good morning to you. Good morning.
Morning.
Okay, not to rush into it, but I was reading an article that I believe next year a Japanese airline is planning to take flight, and one of their engines is going to be run strictly on the biofuel from algae.
Yeah, you can make aviation gas from algae biofuels, and that's it basically performs the same as regular aviation gas. And I think that's one of the only ways in which airlines or airplanes are going to become more greenhouse friendly is by replacing the fuel input with something that's carbon neutral. Because the technology, you can't put a capture device on the back of a jet, otherwise it's not a jet anymore.
Yeah, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, but like out of an acre of algae, they're able to generate 1,200 gallons of fuel versus just a few gallons of fuel from ethanol derived from corn.
Well, I believe it. I haven't actually found the details on that. I mean, that's a research project I'm working on now, is sort of assessing the various renewable claims. We're trying to get the details. Of course, everybody who puts out a press release is, in a way, looking for venture capital. And it, trying to gin up interest, and so you have to sort of dig into the details. But algae grows. The thing about algae, if you remember these pictures of China trying to clear their sailing areas of just this, a carpet of green that grew up in a matter of days, algae's growth rate, and we have, as we have red tides and we have algae blooms, the scale of the growth is enough that you can really get a serious amount of energy out of it.
Is there something about the airlines that make them in a better position to use algae ethanol right now?
Well, it's not ethanol. They would be actually using airplanes fly on something more akin to kerosene.
Mm-hmm. Diesel, you said.
Well, yeah, but you'd isolate it from the diesel fuel. It's a fraction.
Okay.
It's a fraction of the fuel. But the advantage to them running on that is that, since the carbon is captured from the air already by the algae, you're just putting it back in the air. So you're not adding new carbon to the air. You're recycling carbon, circulating carbon that's already in the air. That's the advantage of using any biofuel, as long as you're not clearing land in order to make it, in which case you actually put a lot of carbon in the air in one big fell swoop when you clear the land.
I guess I'm just wondering, could the U.S. be doing this right now?
Oh, I believe the military is indeed looking into this. They're looking at fueling their vehicles with alternative energies, including these technologies, because they would like to make their aviation fleets less dependent on foreign sources of fuel as well. And they certainly could be looking into this.
All right, thanks a lot for that call, Rich. And we take now a call from Richard in Menominee Falls. Hi, Richard.
Yes, hi, good morning. I was told by a gentleman at one point that processing ethanol takes something like 1,700 gallons of water in order to produce 1 gallon of ethanol fuel. Is that correct, Professor? I have no other evidence other than the fact that a gentleman made that comment at a political town hall meeting at one point, and I'm just curious if that's the fact.
Now, it's more like 140 gallons of water to produce a gallon of ethanol. But when you talk about, you know, 15 billion gallons of ethanol, you're talking about a significant amount of water. And we've got a renewable fuel standard that calls for it.
And interestingly enough, last fall I happened to be at a wedding down in Iowa on a pig farm, believe it or not. And the thing that they found so infuriating was the fact that all of their feed was going away because it was being used for ethanol. And that they were finding shortages in feed for their animals because we're, in effect, we're trying to talk about ways of burning our food. We got to be looking for ways. We have a situation in the world today, at least in the United States, where this issue is so politicized, nobody wants to take and really try to figure out a real solution. We've got 15 or 20 different fragmented solutions. And until we can figure out a way as a country to unite and look for a way, we're never going to get there. We are just going to be chasing our tails over little crummy little methods that are not going to take our country anyway. We need to be looking for a new technology, not simply trying to find another fuel that processes the same technology that's gotten us into this current mess.
Well, you raise a lot of good points. I mean, I was reading yesterday about restaurant chains across the country that are shutting down because their food costs have gone up, and they can't raise their prices accordingly because people won't pay it while the economy's not very good, and so whole chains of restaurants are shutting down. People are reeling from higher food prices, and the World Bank says 70-80% of that hike in food prices is because of grain being diverted for ethanol. So it's a very serious issue, and a lot of people are they may not know it, but they're paying the price for these bad decisions right now in terms of their grocery bill and their everything else, that basically all the other costs in their life, transportation costs as well.
Okay, thank you, Richard. And on we go to Jake in Oshkosh. Hi, Jake. Welcome.
Welcome. Basically, stemming off that last conversation, I'm wondering why the government is subsidizing corn for ethanol when it seems like even if they weren't subsidizing it, it would still, you know, cause this market distortion.
Well, that's a great question. There are several different ways the government subsidizes corn, and agricultural subsidies, historically, I've never read a coherent explanation of why we do them other than that government has always found it convenient to do them. But there are some subsidies for corn that automatically go away as the price goes up, but others remain. And so it is still questionable that if oil drops back down to $80 a barrel, ethanol is probably not competitive without subsidies. Because we have, not only do we have a subsidy for growing corn, we have a subsidy for making ethanol and blending it in fuel. We also have a tariff against importing foreign ethanol from Brazil that's made with sugarcane. And so there's multiple levels of subsidies involved. And if you had to replace them all, ethanol probably would not be able to compete.
Okay, thank you for that call, Jake. And let's take one from Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Yes, hello there. I know a man that was working in the oil industry, and I discovered that Thomas Edison, the Thomas Edison, who died in or about the year 1930, I believe, is reported to have discovered that some liquid secretion or some liquid product of the yucca plant, Y-U-C-C-A, could be used to make some kind of liquid that could be used for transportation, something like gasoline. And my friend in the oil company said, yes, well, that would have to wait until the price of gasoline hit, $2 a gallon, so you can realize how long ago this conversation took place. But mm-hmm. I've never heard anything about the yucca plant since then, and I wondered if your guests could make any comments on it.
Hmm. Have you heard of that, Ken Green?
I haven't heard of it, but I'm not surprised. Virtually any plant has a certain amount of starch and sugar in it. If you can squeeze almost any plant hard enough to get some sugar out of it, and you can turn that sugar, or starch, I should say, you can turn that starch into ethanol, and or if the plant is an oily plant, which I believe yuccas are sort of an oil-generating plant, you can make a form of diesel fuel out of them. The problem is, you know, yuccas aren't the fastest growing plants in the world. They don't grow with incredible density. And the amount of sunlight falling on us on an acre of land just won't take you very far in a car. That's why solar-powered cars, you know, creep at very, very slow rates. They can go for a long time when there's sun on the solar cells, but they can't go very fast, and they have to be, you know, have mostly roof and not much car. The amount of sun you get is just limited year to year, and that means the amount of plant matter you get is limited, and the amount of fuel you get is limited.
Okay, let's go to Mike calling from Racine.
It's wind farms.
Oops, can you start over, Mike?
Solar panels.
I don't. Mike, can you hear me? Can you start over there? We missed the first part of your question.
Oh, sorry. Using more electricity or battery-operated vehicles. We already have that sort of technology. And as far as an economic standpoint, we've got Ford and GM plants closing up left and right. During World War II, those plants were converted from cars to making tanks and jeeps. Why can't we use those plants and that factory production to mass-produce wind farms or solar panels?
Oops, we're losing in there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are two aspects to the question. The first is if a plant is failing and you turn it into something where you use government taxpayer money to make something that's not economic, you haven't actually sort of replaced a good economic activity with a different one. You've replaced an economic activity with a non-economic one. In fact, you've sort of doubled down on your losses. But the bigger question is, his real question was, well, why don't we switch to electrifying cars? And that's beginning to happen with the beginning of the plug-in hybrids, the first generation. But they're really still stuck on the another fundamental physics problem. They're stuck on the battery problem. You just can't put enough energy into a battery to take people the distance they feel comfortable with using for their daily commute. Now, that's not rational because most people's daily commute is actually shorter than you can hold a charge on a plug-in hybrid. But nonetheless, markets are what markets are, and people won't buy it if they don't feel comfortable with it. The other question is if everybody's plugging in their car, we're going to have to lay out a lot more electrical generation. And whether it's wind or solar or coal or nuclear, there's going to be a lot more electricity generated. That means a lot more electrical infrastructure, more grid, more power charging installations, quite a lot of hidden costs people don't think about. How much do you suppose it would cost to run, you know, a power socket out to every parking meter and every parking spot? In the country would be a rather huge investment. On the other hand, I think we will move that way to a certain extent because electrification has been the trend for for 100 years now toward more and more use of electricity and less dependence on solid fuels, liquid or solid.
How hopeful are you that you're going to be able to convince the next president to tread carefully with ethanol?
Given our choices in the current election, I would have to say
I'm
not sanguine about the possibility of convincing them to move away. To get to his credit, John McCain historically has been against ethanol. He had an Iowa conversion during the primary season.
In the Corn Belt, yeah.
Yeah, in the Corn Belt, exactly. One doesn't like to say, well, I hope this is a promise he goes back on, but I hope it's a promise he goes back on because it'd be good if he could have an epiphany and realize he was right the first time, and change up his views on ethanol. But currently, they both Obama and John McCain swear by ethanol as a grand thing, motherhood and apple pie, and all that.
Well, if you had to speculate on why that is, what would you say?
Well, in the case of Obama, he has always been in favor of alternative energies, and I think there are people who just sort of let their wishful thinking about the renewables and alternatives guide them into making decisions. They're not particularly concerned about economics, and so it doesn't bother them, the economic considerations. With John McCain, it's hard to explain how you have a change of a long-standing position on the eve of an election, a primary election, but I won't speculate further.
So you're essentially camping out, waiting for the next president after that, or are you hoping to raise awareness at the grassroots level to put some pressure on?
The latter, and I actually think that the pressure is building. There are places in the Midwest where they're actually advertising that they're not using ethanol because of the performance issue. Ethanol doesn't work very well when you start adding it to gasoline for two-stroke engines, small engines. It doesn't work very well. It, you don't get the kind of mileage off of ethanol-blended gasoline that you do off of regular gasoline. So, and it's significant enough that you're not really saving money. You're losing money compared to regular gas. I think there is a pushback beginning. The food crisis is going to be a huge pushback against this. The only question is whether or not who's going to flinch first. If Europe or somebody else backs can manage to crack the farm lobby issue and break away from ethanol, we might see change. But I think if we have another year as we're having with food prices and more diversion of crops to ethanol, people are going to start screaming bloody murder.
Let's take another call now. Here is Patrick with us from Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Perfect segue, because I've done an experiment with my car. I get 10% less gas mileage when I burn an ethanol blend than when I use straight gasoline. So, the economics I can figure out on my own. What I want to know is what's going on there chemically. If by volume I'm getting 10% less out of this blended stuff, is the rest of it going into the environment?
No. The thing is, if you take a cup of ethanol and you take a cup of gasoline, the energy content of the ethanol is only about 70%, or actually 64%, I think, of the energy content of the gasoline, right? It's comparing foods of different calorie levels. There are less calories in the cup of ethanol than there are in the cup of gasoline. And so when you burn them both, you get less energy out, and you go less distance. And so depending on how much of your gasoline has been replaced with ethanol, you'll see a mileage problem. But there's, on top of that, there's the fact that the engines were designed to burn gasoline at a certain temperature, certain compression, certain rate of combustion, and they were not designed to run on the ethanol blends. And so you're losing some your mileage. As for where it burns, I don't think it's not getting dumped out your tailpipe. It burns, combusts, but you just don't get the kind of oomph out of it you would out of gasoline.
Is the same thing true of the algae diesel you're talking about, or switchgrass?
It's the same is true of ethanol made from switchgrass. The difference is sort of when you say biodiesel, diesel is sort of like an oil. It's like oil. It's more dense energy form than ethanol, so it has more calories per cup. Right? Same. Use the same analogy. You'd have oil. If you have a cup of oil, it's similar to having a cup of biodiesel,
mm-hmm.
But more than having a cup of ethanol. So you get more energy out of the diesel derivatives.
We're talking about ethanol today with Ken Green, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His article, Ethanol and the Environment, appears in the Environmental Policy Outlook newsletter from the AEI. Well, we're hoping you'll be weighing in this morning as well with your thoughts on ethanol, your questions. Maybe you've tried it or you have questions about its production or performance. Maybe you're wondering what direction the country should go in terms of ethanol. Do you support John McCain and Barack Obama, who both support ethanol, or do you think it's something we need to tread a little more lightly with and make sure we hit upon just the right solution? Call us this morning with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 11 o'clock, join us for Larry Mueller as he welcomes UW-Madison writing instructor Marshall Cook, who offers advice on putting words to paper. He tells us about his new book, Obsessions, the latest in the Monona Quinn mystery series. That's Larry Mueller coming up after 11. Veronica Rickert back with you today, in for Kathleen Dunn this week, as we talk about ethanol this hour with Ken Green. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And we have an email here from Troy in Menominee Falls I want to read. He says, I heard a professor on the radio say that cellulosic ethanol require harsh chemicals to break them down into ethanol. And as someone who's worked in the environmental consulting field for many years, I immediately thought of hazardous waste. Do you have any sense of how much hazardous waste generation may be a concern with cellulosic-based ethanol?
Sure. Well, that's a good question. the scale of it, I don't think, has been studied yet. To get ethanol out of switchgrass, out of cellulose, you have to first break the cellulose down. And there are several ways of doing that. but they generally require heat and acid in order to break the cellulose down, turn it into starch or sugars so that you can then ferment them and distill them into ethanol. And there is no easy way around that. The reason cellulose is so useful in the biological world, it's, I think, the most common biomolecule, is because it's very, very difficult to break it down. It's very rigid. It's what gives plants their structure. It's what allows trees to be the height they reach the height they do. It's a stiff, rigid, difficult molecule to break down, and it takes aggressive techniques and energy to do so.
And another email here from Mark. What about solar for electric cars, he says? Hemp seed oil for diesel trucks and tractors. Free solar energy once the generators are set up. Hemp grows everywhere with no pesticides or herbicides.
Well, the hemp issue is one that gets into politics of what kind of hemp. There's hemp which results in marijuana, and there's hemp that results in less. But, hemp is another grass crop that has the same sort of issue, which is, again, if you're dependent on crops, that means you're using land. You're dependent on the annual solar input. The same with solar power also, which is the sunlight at the Earth's surface is not very concentrated. That's why you can lay out in it for several hours and not get burned. Whereas, you know, if you put a couple drops of gasoline on your hand, you're certainly going to get burned. And so all of the plant-based based fuels have a problem with this. Solar power for cars, again, solar power can be generated only in a few southwestern states with any sort of reliability. Solar transmitting the power over power lines, you lose it the farther you go, and so you can't really pump it very far. And you don't get a lot of power with a solar-powered vehicle. With solar power, you don't get a lot of energy, a lot of electricity. And there's the battery issue, which is you have to have batteries in the car to store most of the electricity. What you could get off your rooftop of solar cells would be enough to power your cell phone, but probably not much more than that, or a creeper engine to drive a car a couple of miles an hour.
Okay, thanks for your emails, Mark and Troy. And let's go back to the phones now. Here's a call from Roger in Brookfield. Welcome, Roger.
Hi, Roger.
Oh, hi. I was wondering what Mr. Green thinks about compressed natural gas as a long-term solution to this problem with an infrastructure towards hydrogen.
Mm. Compressed natural gas is a reasonable vehicle fuel. It's quite non-polluting. You get a greenhouse gas at the end. You get CO2 and water when it's fully combusted. There are several issues with natural gas. One is that it's already quite expensive and quite scarce and is used for many other things that also pertain to the cost of living, like making fertilizers to grow food, making chemicals, making drugs, making pesticides, making all sorts of useful plastics, making all sorts of things. So natural gas has a very broad market and is already in demand and expensive. And we get it the same way we get oil and gas, which is we drill for it. And there's an aversion to drilling for the major sources of natural gas that are available to us, which is the Outer Continental Shelf and Alaska. Other than that, it's a fine fuel. I don't believe we're going to ever switch to hydrogen. That's a whole other discussion, partly because of the cost of fuel cells, which require very rare elements to work, and the problems of hydrogen infrastructure, which are just unbelievably massive. But compressed natural gas is useful. On the other hand, if we wind up in a liquid natural gas world where people are shipping liquid natural gas back and forth, then the price of that will rise to the world market price, and you won't be any better off than you were with gasoline.
Okay, on to Richard in Elk Mound. Hello, Richard.
Hello. First of all, I drive a Volkswagen diesel, and I get over 50 miles a gallon on the highway going 60. So one of my concerns is, or questions is, just improving the engineering and technology with any fuel we're using. I'm curious about that. But my real focus is on cellulosic ethanol rather than corn, which is an annual. What about the use of a perennial, in this case, which hasn't been discussed, wood? It lives a long time. We've had lots of experience with selective cutting, clear cutting. The paper industry has a way of breaking it down. It isn't as exposed to the variations, and much of the land that wood grows on is only good for that. Is there a future for using timber to produce ethanol, and what are its advantages and disadvantages?
Well, it's, I have read about that. There are people who, in fact, President Bush, when he posed at one of the national laboratories with switchgrass, also had wood chips in another bin that he was showing off poplar chips, I believe they were. Again, all of the plants that you would plant materials are dependent on the exact same thing. There's only so much sun that comes in over a certain period of time, over a certain number of acres, and that means there's only a certain amount of energy that can be trapped in plant matter, no matter what kind of plant you grow. Some are going to be a little more efficient than others, but there can be trade-offs as to how hard it is to cut them down, how easy it is to gather them up and move them. But the fundamental limit is the same. In a given acre, given time, you're only going to get a certain amount of sunlight captured, and you're only going to gain a certain small percentage of that energy out when you make it into a liquid fuel, because you lose energy along the way. So the fundamental limit is there no matter what the species of source matter is.
Thank you for that call, Richard. And on to Mike in Racine. Hello, Mike.
Hi. While I don't disagree with, I think, some of the smaller points that the guest is making, I think he's losing sight of the bigger picture, is that those of us who have been studying the environmental issues and have a science background and have been doing it for 20 to 25 years all understand, and I think this is the consensus among most of the technical community, is that if we are going to try to source our energy from bio-based approaches, is that it's going to be a diverse approach that we're going to have to take, which means that ethanol and biodiesel and methane generation from waste products, these all have to be a part of our portfolio, and all of them are going to require infrastructure technology and technology development, especially when we talk about cars. Just the development of flex fuel technology is not enough. If we're going to efficiently use ethanol, the engines have to be designed, and the designs are already out there. Saab has their biopower car, which is not available in the U.S., but generates more horsepower on ethanol than it does on gasoline. And these are the kinds of forward-looking technologies that have to be developed so that we can most efficiently use the different tools that are out there. And then things about, again, his discussion about the downfalls or the pitfalls, those are the strengths if you look at them from a different perspective, such as ethanol. If we have flex fuel capable vehicles that can take a diverse blending of fuels in order to operate on, then we don't have to ship ethanol. What we can do is generate the ethanol where the excess biomass is at the time, generate the ethanol, generate the bio diesel, whatever the case may be, depending on the local geography, what that climate best grows or develops, and we can use that locally. We don't have to ship it across the country. We can use it down the street, up the road, and so forth. And then lastly, when we, I beg to differ with some of his technical assessments, such as use of water, energy, and so forth, in what it takes to generate either ethanol or biodiesel or whatever the case may be, is that we are not seriously, none of the technology that's out there right now in production is seriously looking at cogeneration, for example, where you use the excess heat from a coal-fired power plant in order to do the distillation process of ethanol so that your net energy return increases dramatically. The same thing can be applied for biodiesel production. And when we talk about the use of water or the hazardous waste deal, the use of water, a lot of that gets recycled. It gets brought back in. Yes, it takes so many gallons, but most often the most efficient producers recover that water and reuse it again. So the net loss of water is not there. And then as far as the biohazards on breaking down cellulose, every cow's stomach on the planet does this without creating a biohazard problem.
Actually, that's not true. That's one of the reasons why they're trying to figure out how to stop cows from generating methane, which is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. That's the byproduct of a cow's breaking down cellulose in its stomach, is methane, and it's a major source of that greenhouse gas in the environment. To get to your point, I have studied environmental sciences since 1990. My doctorate's in environmental science and engineering. I'm fairly conversant with these technologies. But I'm also fairly conversant with economics. I worked with economists for 15 years. And while you hear this all the time from those who only look at environmentalist values, which is, well, we need to do everything all the time, all at once, regardless of its seeming cost effectiveness, no one lives their life that way in any other way. You don't buy indiscriminately regardless of price. You don't invest indiscriminately regardless of price. You don't say, well, we need to buy one house of every kind regardless of price. You look for your best bargains, and you look for your trade-offs, and you figure out what the smart thing to do is. But the romanticism of the environmentalist movement, and in fact the outright sense of panic that has been created by many of them, lead people into this mentality of, well, we need everything all at once, all the time, everywhere. And that actually is an obstacle to the intelligent resolution of these problems. It seems like a gung-ho, I'm enthused, I'm optimistic kind of a point of view, but in fact, it just gets in the way.
So you disagree with the caller's point that if we just invest in a lot of this infrastructure, we can circumvent some of the environmental damage you're talking about, if we make it sort of more regional?
No, I do disagree with him, partly because you can't simply say we're going to grow everything locally for the demand. In Los Angeles, the demand is so high, you'd have to convert all of the local biomass to dent it. In the middle of Kansas, you might have demand low enough that you can grow more locally than you consume. We don't have a uniform sort of a country that way, and it's a bit of Pollyanna thinking to say, well, just we'll find something that grows everywhere and does what we want it to do, even though there's absolutely no evidence that that is the case. And it's not just the United States is trying these things. You know, Japan imports every drop of energy of its oil and its sources of energy, except for nuclear. They've been working on these technologies for every bit as long. They have a better incentive than we do. They haven't cracked the technological issues. Israel is in the same situation, and they're also a technological leader. They often exceed our technological capabilities. They've got every incentive to crack this problem. They haven't had much success. And so to think that we're just going to sort of come up with something because we sort of flail around and try everything, I'm afraid I just don't really believe that.
Well, thank you for your call, Mike. We appreciate your points there.
Thanks, Mike.
We go to Joseph in Holman. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you.
I think perhaps your guest is being a little too dismissive, I think, of a sense of optimism. But it must be a sense, I agree, of guided optimism. And we're not embarking on looking at these technological challenges. There was a wonderful article in Scientific American about the potential for solar. Now, the key word there is the potential. But we're coming up with new ways to increase the solar capacity of what we collect and the space that we collected, providing a smaller area to work with, the idea of setting up a solar electrical infrastructure. Are we talking about a pipe dream? No. Are we talking about a potentiality? Of course we are. But we need to decide what the goal is. It's like when we talk about immigration. We always talk about immigration policy, but we never say what the policy's point is. Same thing with energy. What's our goal? What are we headed for? And even at AEI, and I'd love to work with you guys someday, I kid you not, but even at AEI, we're not saying, what's our goal? What's our policy? What are we looking for sustainability? What are we looking for the alleviation of dependence on foreign sources, not just on foreign sources, but on biological sources that are going to run out at some point in the future? And I don't think we see enough of that. I mean, a perfect microcosm of that is to, you know, I'm sure that every energy company has somebody that they pay a lot of money to figure out what the energy needs of the planet are going to be in the next few years. Was there no one 5 years ago that saw the rise of Russia, the rise of India, or the rise of China? If there wasn't, these guys are way overpaid. And frankly, you know, there's just, I was in India a couple of years ago. I just looked around and read the local news. They were thriving. They were jumping. And for somebody to say, well, we had no idea this was coming, we never saw this, is ludicrous, frankly.
Well, I mean, I agree with some of those things. I agree that this should have been spotted earlier. But I also have an understanding of, you know, if you think of the massive flows and the supply and demand and the ebbs and flows of tightening of supply, it can be pretty hard to spot some of those trends in only a few years. They try to predict 20, 30 years out. It's kind of hard to tell from the short-term data. The thing to understand, though, what I disagree on is we are doing this research on solar. We are doing the research. MIT is doing research on algae biodiesel. Many energy companies are doing research on algae biodiesel and on other forms of ethanol production and biofuel production. We've pumped many, many millions and billions of dollars into research on alternate fuels, electric vehicles, and so forth. We are doing them, and in fact, the market's doing more and more. With gasoline at the price it is, I tell you, anyone who comes up with a replacement that's more cost-effective can write their own ticket. They're the next T. Boone Pickens, right? So I mean, the incentive is already there to generate the new technologies, and the research money is already there. But a sense of humility has to say that some problems are just tough to crack. And fundamental thermodynamic problems like this of energy are very difficult to crack.
Well, what about Joseph's point that we're not thinking directedly enough, that we need to really think about the goal and then maybe work backwards from there once we know what we want? And I should let you know we've got about 30 seconds left for your answer here.
Well, I agree and I disagree. I mean, it'd be nice to know where we're going, but as Friedrich von Hayek pointed out, there's something called the planner's fallacy, that we can actually know where we're going or what the best course is other than what the market tells us is the best thing to do. I tend to be a non-planner. I tend to believe that the best thing to do is to let the market work, make sure that the market is capable of working and making, figuring out the right values we should, for things, and then people will decide what to do based on their buying decisions. I don't really. The reason I don't think we have a policy is to say where we're going is because nobody believes the people who say they think they know where the answer is.
Well, Ken Green, thank you so much for talking this hour. It's been really interesting for me.
My pleasure. It's been interesting for me, too. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Ken Green, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His article, Ethanol and the Environment, appears in the Environmental Policy Outlook newsletter. Thank you to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to Brittany DeAnda for on-air production. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.